We'll call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Monday, May 23rd, 2005. Good morning, everyone. We will start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 675. Open a public hearing on 675. And colleagues, I'm going to break the rules right now in a moment. So, you know, just letting you know that we're going to have the informational hearing as soon as we could locate Senator Ben Westland on the mental health parity bills so that we can have Representative Bruin and Representative Westland testify on those. We have to break the rules because we have a 48-hour rule in effect. It was in effect on Friday, I think.
I'm sorry.
The 48-hour rule before we could...
24 hours.
It's 24 hours. Whatever the deal is, it makes it impossible to be flexible to get the kind of testimony that we need when we need it.
Well, so we're down to 24 hours, and you announced it at the...
It's 24 Friday. Hours of session days. It isn't calendar days.
Right.
And I announced it, but by the time we announced it, it was...
After
4 p.m. So the earliest we could hear, in theory, the measure back up again is after 4 p.m.
Today.
But you announced it in the committee meeting.
Right.
Was that an afternoon?
In the evening session, afternoon session.
Yeah, afternoon session.
Yeah. So, whatever. They can remove me, I guess. With that, we'll bring forward Senator Richard Devlin. Sandy, 675.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 675 comes over to the House Health and Human Services Committee, unamended. There's no revenue, no fiscal. It requires the Oregon Health Policy Commission to study childhood obesity in Oregon for the purposes of developing a comprehensive strategy to address the problem. It left the Senate Health Policy Committee five aye votes, no votes, left the Senate floor 24 ayes, 2 noes, and 4 excused.
Good morning, Senator Devlin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 675. Childhood obesity is an epidemic in Oregon, which I'm sure we all understand. 28% of Oregon's 8th graders and 21% of Oregon's 11th graders are obese. Over the last 20 years, the percentage of Oregon teenagers who are overweight has tripled. This is the result of poor nutritional choices, lack of physical activity, and a culture that encourages these unhealthy habits. Obese children are at risk of developing high blood pressure, heart disease, and type 2 diabetes. The bill before you is a first step toward addressing this issue. I have chosen the Health Policy Commission to address this issue based on its legislative mandate, as stated in ORS 442.045, Article 8. It is the charge of the Health Policy Commission to act as the primary advisory committee to the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research, the Governor, and the Legislative Assembly. SB 675 directs the Health Policy Commission to study and develop a comprehensive plan to reduce childhood obesity in Oregon. This bill will help create a framework to reduce childhood obesity in our public schools and throughout our communities. Colleagues, this is actually a good way for me to indicate, since you've already indicated that Senator Westland is going to be either in this room or is already in this room, the representatives to the Health Policy Commission, if he is in this room, will be all here, because I'm a member of the Health Policy Commission, the chair is a member of the Health Policy Commission, and Representative Greenleaf is a member of the Health Policy Commission. So basically, sometime today, we might have all four of us here. Last fall, my staff and I examined numerous legislative options to address this issue, but decided after much deliberation that the best message was to establish a comprehensive, evidence-based approach. We examined many different types of programs that have been put in effect: mandatory physical education requirements, nutritional requirements, body mass index testing and reporting, what's commonly referred to as right choices education, and media and health campaigns. We even considered introducing three pieces of legislation that have been introduced by others this session: mandatory physical education, nutritional requirements, and body mass index testing. Not to say that there's any problems with those legislation, but the reason we decided to take a different approach is because all of the research that we looked at, and to be quite honest, we examined every state in the United States and every program that they had, would indicate that a comprehensive program is what is really necessary to try to address these issues. We also researched Oregon's current efforts to reduce childhood obesity through the Center for Disease Control's Nutrition and Physical Activity Program to Prevent Obesity and Other Chronic Diseases. Under that program, Oregon is classified as a blue state, indicating that we are in capacity building stage. Oregon health departments are gathering data, building partnerships, and creating statewide health plans, critical groundwork before implementing nutrition and physical interventions. SB 675 allows these approaches to be incorporated into a comprehensive plan to address childhood obesity. Numerous states, as I've indicated, have attempted to address this issue, some successfully, some not so successfully. I thought I would highlight three for you here today. One that has received some positive praise is California. California has instruction on nutrition, obesity, and diabetes, nutritional reform and nutritional content standards in foods and beverages served on campuses, type 2 diabetes screening, and parental notification and counseling of at-risk children. Arkansas was quite controversial, one of the first states to try to address this issue by implementing body mass index screening and parental notification results. Since that time, actually, some of the initial reaction has went away, but at first they had a very negative reaction from parents to the children being sent home with indications that their body mass index was higher than what it should be. Not to say anything disparaging about the chair's former state, but we also examined New York's program. When we first examined this program, we thought this is probably the top-tier program in the nation. It is the most extensive piece of legislation that we have ever found in any state. It included median health campaigns, school and community nutritional education, government food assistance, conferences and program development, data collection and evaluation. However, after contacting some members of the legislature in New York, we found out something very interesting. New York supposedly has a process similar to Congress of authorization and appropriation, and all these programs were authorized. No dollars were ever appropriated for any of them. And actually, the parties we talked to said they've been working on this for a number of years, and it's been difficult to get appropriations. HB 675 applies best practices and successful approaches with a comprehensive involved strategy to combat childhood obesity. It directs the Health Policy Commission to study the problem of childhood obesity, develop a comprehensive strategy based on these findings to address this issue. It will examine childhood obesity in other states, consider the recommendations of appropriate nutrition and physical education authorities, conduct discussions with local, state, and federal officials regarding childhood obesity, review just existing childhood obesity programs in this state, and report its findings to the governor and the 74th Legislative Assembly. Though many solutions, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, have been proposed in the legislature, SB 675 opens a broad discussion that will lead to a comprehensive approach. The bill allows concerned groups to coordinate their efforts to launch a united front against this epidemic. The purpose of this bill ultimately is to ensure the health and well-being of Oregon's children and the future of future generations. Mr. Chairman, in closing, the one thing I would like to say about this is sometimes people talk about creating task forces. First, let me put two things on the record. One, before this session ever started, we decided that the best course of action in this particular legislative session was to make a more clear examination of this issue. We also decided that we should follow what we had told the public and told many that we were going to follow in the previous session. We had created a health policy commission to examine major health care issues in the state, including health care and health issues. This is clearly in their charge. I've discussed it with the committee. They have a unique capability to bring many people to the table. How I imagine this will be approached is probably a separate work task force will be created. They can bring people to the table that it would be difficult for me to bring to the table. And I think we can actually report back into the next legislative session a fairly comprehensive program with different levels of options that the legislature can explore in the next session in a fully informed manner. Therefore, I urge your support for this resolution and this Senate bill, and hope that the chair will grant it a work session sometime in the near future.
Okay. Thanks very much, Senator Devlin. Questions or comments? Thank you.
Well, I would like to support what Senator Devlin said. There were several bills this time, and there wasn't a systematic approach to where we need to go with this. It would seem to me it would be very useful for the Health Policy Commission to take this up as a sort of focus one of its several focuses in the next time to get ready for the next session. I expect it might anyway, but I think this would help it happen.
Senator, the three of us sit on the Health Policy Commission, as you pointed out earlier. I'm curious, do we need legislation to get the Health Policy Commission to take this up?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it would be absolutely necessary to have legislation. I think it would be helpful, though, because it would establish a process whereby the legislature, when they identify a major public health issue, have asked the Health Policy Commission to address it. I prefer this option rather than people trying to create additional task forces. And the other thing is, I think it gives clear legislative direction that this is an important issue to the legislature. We've discussed the issue in the Health Policy Commission and in working groups that they have created. What I'm looking for, though, is more of a lot of people can sit around the table and have a rump discussion about what are the problems with childhood obesity. I'm looking more for some direction so that they do more comprehensive approach, bring people in with a great deal of background in the area that they have the ability to bring into this discussion, and that we report back something that is actually fairly concrete. Something that the legislature can actually utilize. And when the legislature gives a direction that it wants some guidance on this issue, I think it will be helpful for the legislature to have asked for it in this session.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you,
Senator.
Richard Morley.
Sure, Delta members.
Wait, who invited Katie King up? You still have to answer for Friday.
Chair Delta, members of the committee, my name is Gretchen Morley. I'm the director of the Health Policy Commission. I've also invited Katie King to join me up here. I just want to add a couple of things to what Senator Devlin said. I am here to express Health Policy Commission's support for Senate Bill 675. As he said, the commission is currently working with VHS and other partners to figure out what the commission can be doing to elevate health promotion efforts in the state, and so Senate Bill 675 is a valuable addition in terms of focusing those efforts. Why I invited Katie up here is I have been in conversation with Dr. Malcone at VHS in terms of forming a tight partnership around implementing 675, because they do indeed have the staff resources expertise to be able to make sure that this study involves the partners and the content matter that it needs to.
Katie King, Intergovernmental Relations Liaison for Health Services in the Department of Human Services. And just to echo what Gretchen said, we're very excited about the opportunity to work with the Oregon Health Policy Commission on this issue. And it's a priority for health services. And so thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Seeing no one else signed up to testify, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 675. Representative Bruin, we're going to get to Senator Morse first, and then we'll come back around. Oh, I don't even see him.
I think he stepped out.
So he stepped out. Okay. Senate Bill, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 541, the Task Force on Electronic Medical Records Bill. I don't have the sign-up sheet. Senator Morse, you want to come forward?
Do you want me to just go through it with you?
Okay. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 541B comes over from the Senate Health Policy Committee. No revenue impact, but it does have a fiscal statement, and it should be attached to your staff measure summary. Left the Health Policy Commission unopposed. The vote on the Senate floor was 28 ayes, 0 noes, and 2 excused.
Okay. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Frank Morse, State Senator, District 8. I realize I may be preaching to the choir here just a bit with two members of the panel on the Oregon Health Policy Commission. You will recognize this as an extension of the work that was done by the Subcommittee on Electronic Health Records and Data Connectivity that was chaired by Dr. Jody Pettit, who joins me at the desk here this morning, as well as Dr. Bruce Goldberg. I'd like to just make a reference to some of the reporting that came out of that subcommittee. From the executive summary, the statement was that although the United States has one of the most technologically advanced healthcare systems in the world, it relies predominantly on a 19th century record-keeping system. This antiquated paper-based record-keeping system and the barriers it imposes on appropriate data sharing is a source of harm and excess costs to Oregonians. The state of Oregon can assist substantially in transformation of the system by adopting electronic health records and health information exchange. This bill is a logical extension of the activities that were already undertaken by the subcommittee, and it's a bill that has had pretty intense involvement from the stakeholders in the healthcare industry and support to move this forward. The bill addresses a task force composed of 15 members representing the industry. I won't go into the detail of that. The duties of the task force are to make recommendations for the technical architecture that assures the security and confidentiality of health data as it is exchanged between appropriate healthcare providers. It makes recommendations on the development and promotion of national standards for the transfer and exchange of electronic medical records and health-related data between healthcare providers, third-party payers, and other authorized users. Its task will be to make recommendations on ways to promote use of electronic records by rural providers and small provider groups. Its task also will be to convene and coordinate community-based health information exchange projects to assure that comprehensive security and confidentiality protections are built into Oregon's health information exchange systems. Also to make recommendations on the most appropriate method to match a patient's identity across healthcare settings. To make recommendations on the formation of public and private partnerships to build infrastructure and health information applications and the exchange of electronic medical records and health-related data, develop coordinated regional frameworks for sharing electronic health information, conduct outreach to and training of business leaders on the costs and benefits of adopting standards, identify additionally those laws or regulations that impede the development and implementation of applications for the transfer and exchange of electronic medical records, and then to report periodically to the Oregon Health Policy Commission and appropriate legislative committees on the technology and recommendations. And also to define one or more pilot projects that will develop the technical, legal, and governance infrastructure for a regional health information exchange for Oregon. The staffing for this activity is anticipated that and Dr. Goldberg can address this issue, is that we will be redirecting existing resources and then applying for grants to achieve this and carry out the task of this activity. This is a pretty high priority on a national basis in terms of developing standardized architecture for electronic exchange of information in the healthcare industry. So it's anticipated that we will be receiving grants to further this this task force. I'd like to just make one comment with respect to the referral to the budget committee. Since we're not asking for funds, I believe that may be an exercise in abundance of caution, so to speak. But I understand that we do have a referral to budget. So, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I defer to Dr. Pettit, and she can address the some of the issues of need for this, and then Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for hearing this bill. I'd like to talk a little bit about the need for health information technology. Your health care information is strewn all over the place. Your medical chart is in fragments, existing partially at the hospital, partially at the clinic, partially in computers, and largely on paper. It's definitely not in one place, and it's not readily accessible. Imagine having a medical record that is complete, organized, and available to you or your health care provider when you need it.
Dr. Petter, I need to have you sign in for the name, sign in for the record. Just your name, please.
Oh, Jody Pettit.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. Now imagine it being private and secure and under your control. Now think of a health record infused with the finest evidence-based medical knowledge regarding your conditions. And finally, consider the significance of having a single, lifelong, non-redundant record. This change in information infrastructure from institution-centric to person-centric will serve as the cornerstone for delivering the highest quality patient-centered care. It is a necessary shift to improve the safety, efficiency, and effectiveness of healthcare. It is also the requisite vehicle to reduce high-cost but low-benefit care. This is achievable, and Senate Bill 541 will help us get there. There are technical, legal, and political issues to tackle, and I'll just say a few words about each. There are many technical issues, but to simplify it, I will address the two major ones. That's electronic health record adoption and interoperability. Currently, most outpatient information is on paper. Adoption of electronic health records will eventually convert paper records to electronic format. The other issue is that of interoperability, and interoperability refers to the ability of one system to send, receive, and use data from another system. We don't have to wait for all the clinicians to be on electronic health records. We can start interoperability projects where data already exists in electronic format, and our health systems are a good example of this. Legal issues, privacy and security of health data are of paramount importance. Appropriate access control will need to be instituted and data sharing agreements created. Political issues, these are the most challenging. The state can facilitate by convening various entities from the private and public sector to form a common vision and a common plan. The bill calls for formation of a broad-based task force comprised of knowledgeable stakeholders that can guide this effort. We envision a healthy public-private partnership. We can do this. Oregon has a long history of collaboration, a record of innovative health policy, and we are again positioned to serve a leadership role in this country. In conclusion, building better health information infrastructure is imperative for meaningful change in our healthcare system. We need to get started. The sooner we do, the more we can save, both in lives and money. Thanks.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Administrator of the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. Just very briefly, I think all of us know we're grappling with a number of problems in healthcare: rising numbers of individuals without health insurance and without access to care, rising costs of care, uneven and fragmented quality of care. There is no real silver bullet for these problems. Instead, there are a number of solutions that we can engage in, and indeed, better efficiency, connectivity, and building an electronic health infrastructure for the state is one of the ways that we can help provide better access, improve quality, and hopefully address the issues of cost by bringing evidence to the point of decision making, decreasing redundancy. This bill will help us do that. It will help direct the resources of the office to move the state forward in an effort that was started this past year, and we can move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Goldberg, I think this is a wonderful idea. I understand this is just to set up the task force, but we're at a place where we are in danger of really hurting our Medicaid Oregon Health Plan program if more doctors retire or leave practice. And I think all of the younger doctors more than likely are going to be excited about this, being able to transfer things around the state. But some of the older doctors, as they near retirement, may not be so excited, may not want to purchase the equipment. What do you see as far as the possibility of this actually cutting down the core of physicians and health professionals.
Representative Chair Dalto and Representative Anderson, as my kids keep referring to me as one of those older doctors, so I think I can speak to that. What this task force will do is help plan in a meaningful way so we can address some of the issues that you've raised. Clearly, not everybody is going to be an adopter of this. This bill doesn't mandate that everybody adopt the technology. What I would hope would happen is that this task force would help us look at ways we can teach old dogs new tricks. We can do a number of other things, but I think that's exactly what this bill will do, is help address that issue. We don't want to force anybody away from delivering care. If anything, we want to make it easier. We want to make it more efficient. We want to help provide greater access, and that's what this will help do.
Keep in mind that some doctors can learn to be legislators.
Mr. Chair, if I may also comment to Representative Anderson.
New occupation.
The healthcare organization that I've been involved with in governance structures in the Mid-Valley, Samaritan Health Services, we have invested $68 million, and it's an ongoing information technology improvement. When we began this, the doctors were quite resistive, and now they're asking for it. So I think as these systems evolve throughout the state and tremendous amounts of investments are being made, it's absolutely essential that we create some type of a common architecture so that when patients go through our system and they wind up getting up to OHSU or St. Vincent's or referred elsewhere or move, that those records can move easily and efficiently and avoid the kind of repetition and costs and workups from one doctor to another. But our experience has been initially resistance, and now they're asking for these new tools.
Mr. Chair, Mayor. I let me just comment from the perspective of a patient in a system whose medical record is available electronically anywhere. I happen to wander into thousands of physicians who would be in the Kaiser Permanente system. It's really quite amazing. I mean, I worked on the other side of that starting in 1980 to help get a system like that implemented, but being a patient and having the example of whether I'm seen in Portland or in Salem, when I'm handy to be seen and I stop and see an optometrist here because I'm having eye problems, and that person has my whole record in front of them, just readily available, and being able to enter into it wherever I show up, has been really quite extraordinary. And we are moving in this direction, there's no question about it, but the problem is we're moving in this direction, in this system doing one thing, in this system doing another thing, in the third system doing something else, and in private practice physicians not affiliated with the system struggling to try and figure out what to do that can bring them into this model. I see Tom holding them back, and we had a meeting a couple of weeks ago about a bill to try and give pharmacists more flexibility in terms of how to deal with the prescribing that they get from physicians. And the answer is, well, just think of how this would be solved if we had electronic prescribing for everybody in the state in a system that could just work these out. I mean, this has to come. And it needs, from a state perspective, something like this kind of task force to begin to move it forward, to get some common ground, some neutral ground where people can talk about these things, where some of the technical matters can be dealt with, as well as some of the political matters. And I think the subcommittee of the Health Policy Commission did a great job doing the background work that allowed this to get into this, into the kind of place we are. So I sort of congratulate Bruce and Jody for the work that they did to help it. Bruce says Jody. They're both pointing at each other. It's been kind of amazing, and I thank Senator Morris and others for bringing this to us, including Dr. Anderson, right? See your name on this thing. Yeah, what are you complaining about? See, there's an old dog that can learn new things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, all right, thank you. Thank you all very much. Kathy Britton, is Kathy Britton available via video conference?
Yes, she is. Representative Dalton, can you hear me? Great. Thank you. Thank you for indulging me the opportunity to present my information to you via video conference. And for the record, my name is Kathy Britton. I am the telehealth coordinator for Asante Health System here in Medford, and I am bringing this testimony to you on behalf of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council and the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. Representative Greenlick was exactly right when he said that this is something that is coming and we can have it done to us or we can develop it for ourselves. One of the things that I think is very difficult is when we get federal legislation that says that we will establish something like this and provides the guidelines that may or may not fit what is happening and what needs to happen in our state. By instituting a task force of this nature, we are able to participate in our own future. And I think this is of critical importance. One of the things that is extremely important to us as the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon is that we are attempting to establish a statewide backbone for the use of healthcare, be it for information or for consultation or for the use of the myriad of other telemedicine tools that are becoming available for use on the market today. However, we're not going to be able to build a robust system on that network that will benefit patients in terms of access and that will benefit providers in terms of their ability to use those tools without a standardized healthcare information system and a means to move it in a secure way. We were very excited to be able to participate in the discussions around this task force and are very eager to see it move forward. We believe that the addition of people that might not normally be seen as partners in this is of critical importance. For example, telecommunications companies will end up playing a critical role in this because of the determination about the technology that's going to be needed to best make this happen. The inclusion of payers in this is also of importance, not only from the standpoint that they are one of the biggest recipients of healthcare information, but as a private partner, they will have the funds to help make this happen. And this is going to be an extremely costly proposition, and we're certainly going to need all of the funds that we can garner in putting this together. This is an exciting public-private partnership. Oregon is known for solving its problems with public-private partnerships, and we fully support the developing the solutions for this need in that way. So we would like to offer our support and hope that you will consider creating this task force through this legislation. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kathy. Questions or comments? Thanks, Kathy.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's have the lights back, please.
It's like 5:30 in the morning.
Patricia Scruggs, please.
I don't use this model.
Where she goes.
Good to go.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. I need to make sure I remember my question. Pat, I've often thought about Oregon as almost being the perfect size for being a beta test site for a statewide integrated system. Is there the possibility that there are venture capital funds and other kinds of funds that could be brought to bear to take this task force to the next step? I mean, we just seem so logical for this. And is that something OEC, DD, whatever?
Yes, I would agree that we're a perfect size for a good beta test site. We have venture capital firms in the state that do invest, and in the Northwest that do invest in health IT. The Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, which tries to bring together the VCs, the industry, universities, and government to address these issues, which hopefully will be going into Oregon Innovation Council here shortly, is the exact kind of group that can help, I think, champion that specific issue. So the short answer is yes, I think we have the capacity here in the industry, we have the funding, and we have people behind it at both the industry side and the government side that would be willing to work together to do that.
I assume I can just move on since the chair's up. Further question? Thank you. You're talking about more jobs, and more jobs aren't going to emerge unless we move it the next step. Do you have some suggestions or of what we can do in the interim to push this further? I mean, would there be some way to amend this bill that would make some sense to push to the next step? Is there anything we need to do, or do we need to sit back and wait for the task force report and then have proposals out of the task force that could push this in some sensible way?
Chairman, Representative Greenlee, I would suggest the task force here with the membership that it has and its private sector and the other things, you would allow them to do their work. We mentioned today the federal funding that would be available and the grants available for this. That's probably one of your best ways to get some of these beta testing. So I would allow that task force to do that and have those recommendations accordingly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. Yes. We'll invite up Gwen Dayton and Scott Gallant.
Scott's not going to tell us there's some felony buried in this bill, is he?
For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I think my testimony will be relatively brief because the Hospital Association strongly supports all the testimony that's already been provided. I won't repeat it other than to indicate that the state has been engaged in a very healthy debate about healthcare cost and quality. And the development of regional electronic medical record is a strong part of providing the best possible care we can at the lowest possible cost. And for that reason alone, we're very supportive of it. This bill in particular, though, I think will be a strong step forward for Oregon because, you know, a number of organizations have been working on the development of an electronic medical record, including the Hospital Association. We can now bring these organizations together, combine our resources, our ideas, our thoughts, and work together towards overcoming some of the challenges associated with an electronic medical record, because even though this is something we must do, it won't be easy. There are barriers. There are going to be challenges. And by working together, bringing all of our resources to bear, I have no doubt that we can overcome them and develop solutions that work for everyone. And so we're very supportive of the task force and look forward to lending our resources and our ideas to finding solutions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I do.
Representative.
Have the hospitals begun to work on this independently among the competitors to at least make, say, hospital discharge databases available in case a patient shows up somewhere else? Has the work begun in that area?
Representative Greenlee, the Hospital Association internally has its own work group that looks at privacy issues generally, but we've also started to take on the issue of the electronic medical record. And what we have done is look at things like the legal issues associated with it. What about HIPAA? What about STARC? What about some of the these challenges? How do we want to overcome them? What are the contracting issues? What do we need to make sure are included in contracts with providers that are going to participate in this? Some of the technical work we are already working on, and we're glad to lend to give that work to the task force as well.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant with Oregon Medical Association. We also lend our support for this concept in this bill. I'll make a couple of observations. One of the biggest barriers to this endeavor happens to be cost. The cost per physician is approximately $30,000 to $40,000, and then there are ongoing costs affiliated with keeping the information and the systems updated. It's very expensive to implement. We too believe that this is inevitable, and it's good for us to go down this path, and we're all going to go down this path. But there are a lot of issues, not just financial, but others, that probably need to begin to be thought of and discussed, including how the clinical information is used and analyzed, and who has access to that information, and how that information is going to be used in the process. I think almost everyone believes that in order to have a, I'm not sure I like this term, robust system, the real critical player or players in this process are physicians. They will be the ones who will fundamentally provide information for analyzing health trends, performance standards, etc., as these systems develop. So we think it's very important to have a comprehensive plan which a task force of this nature can produce. I also believe that the legislation should be a bit more forthright and actually deal with some of the costs associated with this and what it will take. The Medical Association just a few months ago endorsed a proposed legislation to help find funding at the federal level for the very reason that you've raised. We also believe that Oregon is small enough that we ought to be able to do a statewide system that makes sense for everyone in the process. And it's relatively inexpensive, somewhere around $80 to $150 million. You know, there are 8,200, by our statistics, there are 8,200 clinically practicing physicians in the state, which is not a large number. And they're, you know, have multi-affiliations with hospitals and other systems. So it is a good opportunity, and it makes rational sense to have a comprehensive plan that addresses all of the various aspects of this. Electronic medical records are not, as was mentioned, I believe, by Dr. Goldberg, a silver bullet, however. You know, I wouldn't want you to believe that this will fix a multitude of things easily. There are going to be problems. There already have been problems where companies or hospitals in some instances have purchased systems where the medical staff has been absolutely angered that the system did not meet its promises, it was more inefficient, and it had significant problems. And we're going to go through those phases, but it can be exceedingly expensive when you do. But anyway, this is a very important bill, I think, to begin to lay the base for some things that we know we're all going to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Just a very brief comment. I think the point you just made is really interesting. It is a matter of scale, isn't it? I mean, if you're talking about $30,000 a physician, you're talking about $80 million for the whole state. You now got the $30,000 down to $10,000 a physician. And that's a, I mean, it really, we are of a place where we could kind of scale this kind of system in a way that would make a ton of sense.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlit. I think everyone also knows who's at least read the literature that the real key in this process are small practices. Most practices in Oregon and elsewhere in the country really aren't in large multi-specialty clinics that may have greater resources. They're actually the small one and two based practices. And the proportionate or disproportionate impact of those sorts of costs and the expertise that you need to keep them upgraded and functioning really can be significant for a small practice. So what we've tried to do in the federal bill is to focus on small practices, not the Portland clinics that have already begun to do that work on their own in an incremental way. So I would agree.
Okay. Gwen, did you have a chance to present already?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
All she said is they absolutely support it.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, seeing nobody else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 541, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 541B. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 404. Sandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 404A comes to us from the Senate Human Services Committee with a 3-aye votes, 2 excuse votes. There's no revenue or fiscal impact statement to the bill. This modifies the current criteria for participation in rural health services program. It expands the programs to include pharmacists, and it has an emergency clause effective July 1, 2005. And the floor vote, it left the Senate chamber 25 ayes, 0 noes, and 5 excused.
Okay, thanks, Tom Holt. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Our members are pharmacists and pharmacy technicians. Here in support of Senate Bill 404A, one of the things that the bill does, as staff mentioned, is it adds pharmacists to the program. Like other health professions, when we look at the rural areas of the state, the demographics and the recruiting conditions are a little bit scary. Our typical student now graduates, as do others from professional schools, with a fairly high amount of debt. But when we look at the numbers now, we believe we have more pharmacists retiring than are actually entering the workforce. And our rural workforce is at least 5 years older than the workforce in the valley high population areas. So we've been involved in the discussions on this and other bills related to rural health in this session. What our language does, and it's language that we worked out with the Office of Rural Health, is target assistance here to those pharmacists who agree to practice in a rural area. We leave the exact criteria to the Office of Rural Health to determine, but a couple of criteria that are important to point out is that the pharmacist would have to agree to practice at a rural hospital, rural health clinic, or at a pharmacy that's not part of a group of six or more pharmacies. That aims at the small communities that probably will never be of interest to a large pharmacy operation but are very much at risk of losing pharmacy services right now. So we think it would be a good start. I mean, the agreement here is basically sort of an ROTC program kind of arrangement. The person newly graduated has to agree to practice for at least 5 years or 3 years and can get some relief from student loans, state student loans, for 3 years, 4 years, and 5 years of service. That would be of some help in recruiting people to these areas that are very difficult to recruit to for our new graduates. A lot of things have changed in the nature of a new professional school graduate, and I won't get into all that as we face basically the same problems as other professions in that respect, and just that it's getting a lot harder to recruit people to these areas. This is a small carrot to offer to people to at least take a second look, or hopefully a first look, at some areas that are greatly underserved in our state. And with that, I'd be happy to take questions.
Questions, Representative Cameron?
Yeah, thank you. Seen a lot of these rural bills. In fact, went to Ontario and listened to some tax credit issues. What about the pharmacist that comes out without any debt and says, hey, I want to go to rural Oregon?
Chair Adulto, Representative Cameron, there's another bill in the House Revenue Committee that would offer some tax credit relief to various professions, including pharmacists, and we're also supportive of those efforts. This is just another tool in the toolbox. I don't know too many, though, that graduate without debt. They're very rare. It's a long haul. It's our typical student now has a four-year undergraduate degree, even though they're only required to do 3 years of pre-pharmacy, and they have 4 years after that. So they're in our average age entering now is 26, which sort of reflects the need to try to stoke up the savings account a little bit before they enter.
So there is no such student that comes out without a state loan?
Chair Dalto, Representative Camera, I've been in my job now almost 7 years. I've yet to meet a graduate who doesn't have debt.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, briefly, Mr. Chair.
Very briefly. I just like to comment, when we were in Heppner, I happened to sit at dinner that night that the community provided for us next to a woman who runs a small family-owned group of about, I think, probably four stores in those rural areas, and she just told me the nightmare of what it was to try and keep pharmacists coming in those stores and try and keep them open. So this, I think it was a very telling story, and I think a very compelling story, and I think this is this kind of important piece.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 404A. And how many people are in the audience here to talk about mental health parity that was carried over? Just Representative? Okay, Representative Bruin. So, Representative Bruin, we don't have this on the agenda, so I have some questions about mental health parity that I would like to have you come and answer for me. So would you come forward, please? Thank you very much.
Am I here just to take questions or can I make a statement?
My question is, what is on your mind about mental health parity?
Oh, I know.
Very well done. thank you, Chair Adulto and committee, for this opportunity. I appreciate it. I know it's a sort of a special case, so you've given me something for the logbook if I'm ever committee chair on how to do this, and I appreciate that. It's a little instructional for this freshman. I'm here in strong support State Representative Scott, I should know that by now. State Representative Scott Bruin, House District 37. Thank you. I am here in strong support of SB 1 and HB 2913, in short, the mental health parity bills. And as a freshman, and I know there's some of your more senior members would probably argue that at this point in my political career, there's not a whole lot I know. What I do think, maybe Representative Cameron can join me on this, what I do think I know, though, is that we take dozens of votes in committees on the House floor every single day, and I think when it's all said and done, the final analysis, very few of those votes that we do are going to matter in the larger scheme of things. I don't mean to undermine or denigrate, but very few of them are rememberable. A lot of them are cleanup. I think there's only going to be a handful of bills when it's all said and done that we will, with pride, be able to take back to our friends, our family, and our constituents, and that we can argue fundamentally change Oregon for the better, and I believe the mental health parity bills are among those. Senate Bill 1 and House Bill 2913 are the right thing to do, and I believe that their time has come. I want to tell you why I'm so personally passionate about these bills, and the reason I think we should do them, but before I do that, let me briefly address the criticisms of the mental health parity bills, because I think they are real criticisms, they're valid, and I don't think we can discount them. Please make no doubt that SB 1 and the related bills will create an increased financial burden on small business in this state. To argue anything less, I think, would be disingenuous. I can speak to this directly because my business, which is a general contractor located in Portland, has seen annual health care expenses increase at a rate of 12 to 18% over the last 5 or 6 years. And that's just, not to mention the general liability insurance that we have to pay that's also gone up.
Per year, right?
That's per year. Not to mention the GL insurance that we have to pay, which has gone up astronomically since 9/11. And I think it's fair to say that if we were to do these mental health, if we're to do SB1, the mental health parity, I know people will argue and differ about what the cost number is, but I think it's fair to say that it will be at least a 3-5% increase in a business's annual health care expense. But let's make sure, Mr. Chair and committee, that we understand the true problem with these costs. The problem with health care is not that we take care of people. It's not that we prescribe drugs to people who need care or medical treatment. It's that we have a health system that is so completely out of whack in today's terms. You just were talking about this. It's a World War II model that hasn't changed, and I don't know if it's a failed system, but if it's not failed, it's very close. Among other things, we stifle medical competition, we remove the consumer from the cost and purchasing decisions, we wait to address issues when they're chronic instead of truly addressing health and wellness, and as you were just, the 2 bills ago, which was very coincidental, we have the most advanced medical technology in the world, but we've got an IT system for the medical fields, if you will, that's at least 2 or 3 decades, if not more, behind the time. These, committee, are the issues that this state and this nation needs to address when we're talking about reining in the costs of health care. In my mind, none of these issues are going to be solved by withholding or severely rationing physical and or mental health care treatment. Nevertheless, our friends in business and our business lobby groups have said that have raised these issues about the costs with mental health parity, and I think those are true issues and true things to consider. But I do hope that our friends in business and in the business lobby will understand that this legislature is working hard to make Oregon a better and a more friendly place to do business. Among other things, we're looking to expand enterprise zones and the strategic investment program. We're working to improve the tax and regulatory structure. We're working to reduce capital gains taxes as one thing among many. We're looking to improve the land use for more shovel-ready land. So I think we can go back to our constituents and our business friends and say, listen, we are doing what you've asked us to do. We are trying to make this state a better place to do business. We'll do this for business because it is the right thing to do. But at the same time, we have to, with all due humility and all due respect, ask business to do the right thing for their employees, both current and prospective, for those employees that have mental health care issues. Let me wrap this up by explaining to you why I'm so personally passionate about mental health care parity. I didn't want to wear this on my sleeve when the session started, but I found myself on a couple of occasions having to refer to this. Chairman knows what I'm referring to. I am somebody who lives with type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, and I am a cancer survivor as well. Left untreated or poorly treated, the diabetes and the cancer would have killed me, while the arthritis would have put me in a wheelchair. But instead, I run, I lift weights, and I climb mountains. And as my wife says, I am the healthiest unhealthy person she knows. I can do all of this for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is that I take care of myself. But in addition to that, I have always had, and God willing, will always have, some of the best medical treatment that insurance can provide. That is why, for me, it seems so fundamentally unfair that I should be so well taken care of, yet somebody who has a mental health care disease is either marginally taken care of or not taken care of at all. To me, it's fundamentally unfair. I believe that there should be no difference. They both affect quality of life. They both affect your ability to function in both job and social settings and family. And in fact, you could make an argument that with mental health care diseases, the toll on family and social settings may even be worse than somebody in a wheelchair, as one example. Now, I know we need to acknowledge that this is change. It's fundamental change and it's big change. But I think it's change whose time has come. We have done things the way this World War II model, we have always done that. But what I convey and ask you is to make this change finally happen. Let's disenthrall ourselves with the way we do this. Let's bring on mental health care parity. We haven't been just talking about this session. We've talked about it for multiple sessions, as far as I understand. It's gone through the ringer. It's had a fair hearing. I think the people of Oregon, we owe them this. I think it's time. So I'd ask this committee to, in the most expeditious manner, move SB1 and the related House bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bruin. Thanks for waiting for us. We're here to accommodate some people's schedules. at a cost of yours. Questions or comments? I think you're all set. Thanks very much. And so then the next thing the chair is wondering is who this person is in the front row there that would like to speak and what they have on their minds. So if you'd like to come forward. Just start by introducing yourself. And
I'm Jake Steckley. I'd like to tell a story of how the insurance and my family's disabilities have affected my life. Mr. Chair and committee, when I was really young, my brother and my dad both had problems. My brother was mentally ill, and my father was an alcoholic and a drug addict. Throughout the beginning of my life, I never knew there was anything wrong with my family. I was happy. I didn't have any problems. I had a great house, a great yard, but my brother had always been going to psychiatrists and psychologists, and my mother and my father paid for that, and I'm not sure whether that was through insurance or not, but when my parents got divorced, we didn't have any money, my mom, and we had to pay for everything just out of our pocket after a few paid-for counseling visits and psychologist visits. We had to just pay for that out of earned money. So, and after that, I didn't know there was anything really wrong with my father, and I knew my mom had been in debt already from my brother, and my dad decided to go to get drug treatment because he had run out of money. So child support stopped, and any help paying for Alex had my brother had just stopped from insurance and my father. So when my father went to treatment, he couldn't pay for it. He had no way. My mom had to pay for it just for the deposit out of her credit card. So that put her in more debt. And that was for my dad, who there was not very much hope for anyways. And when we went to counseling and stuff to talk to him, we had a lot of problems talking to him about how we dealt with it, and Alex didn't even come, and so he was just suppressing his feelings even more and having no time with my father for years, basically, and not being able to go see a counselor or anything. For me, just that put me in a really bad situation for a lot of things, you know, not being able to talk to my dad or my mom, both my mom working a lot and my dad not being here. We tried to handle the money situation, but that didn't work out, really. It has now, because both my mom and my father are, they work together, they both pay for things through their own money, and insurance barely helps. So that's pretty much my story.
Okay. Yeah. We appreciate it very much, Jake. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else on mental health parity? Seeing none. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 913A. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 913 comes to us from the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's directing the Department of Human Services to suspend or opposed to terminate, as opposed to termination, medical assistance for a person with serious mental illness who becomes an inmate in a public institution. Attached, hopefully, to your staff measure summary, there is a fiscal impact statement However, this does not have a subsequent referral. You will notice under the comment section, the first sentence says, the fiscal impact of this measure is minimal. They provided the impact more for comment than anything else. This bill left the Senate floor with 22 ayes, 0 noes, and 8 excused.
Okay, Michael Morris. And Ginger Martin. Good morning, welcome.
Chair Dalton, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Morris, and I am the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 913A. As described, this bill would allow us to suspend benefits as opposed to terminating benefits for individuals with serious mental illnesses who go into a public institution. Currently, if an individual with a serious mental illness ends up in the jail and they are eligible for medical assistance benefits, those benefits are terminated when they enter the institution. Then when they are beginning to work on release, one of the issues is the transition planning and providing for the health care that they are needing, which includes medication and other mental health services. Currently, it takes weeks to then go about and reapply for those benefits. And what this bill would do is make those benefits readily available at the time that they are released into the community. The Governor's Mental Health Task Force report has a recommendation that supports the policy outlined in this Senate bill. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Mr. Morris? Okay, Ginger.
Chair Dalton, members of the committee, I'm Ginger Martin, an assistant director for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information in support of Senate Bill 913A. There are about 14% of inmates in DOC prisons today who suffer from serious to severe mental illness. While these individuals are incarcerated, the Department of Corrections works to stabilize their condition and develop effective treatment plans and also to coordinate their care with community mental health providers at their release. You've heard testimony on what can happen when they are disenrolled from their Medicaid or Medicare programs when they enter prison, and then the gap that occurs when they leave, when they have to reapply for benefits for which they had been eligible. This is currently a state policy that they be disenrolled. It isn't a requirement of the federal government, and hence we have Senate Bill 913 that would require the state to suspend these benefits rather than terminating them, and this suspension allows for a much quicker reinstatement of benefits at the time that they're released from incarceration. We do think that this period of time directly after a person leaves prison is particularly a time of vulnerability, and as much as we can provide supports for those individuals, we know that breaks in treatment and mental health care for individuals who have serious problems does lead to reinstitutionalization in either a jail or a psychiatric hospital. Both of these options are expensive, and so an unbroken continuation of service is cost-effective. Under this bill, as part of the inmates' release planning, the department would notify the Department of Human Services of the date that the inmate would leave prison. The Department of Human Services would then have the opportunity to reassess eligibility and reinstate that for those who continue to qualify for assistance. Authorizing a seamless provision of mental health services from community to prison and back to community for the seriously mentally ill is in the best interest of the patient and also of the citizens of Oregon. And so we respectfully request your support of Senate Bill 913A.
Thank you. Any questions for or comments from Ms. Martin? Senator Greenlee.
Is this intended to include substance abuse treatment as well as mental health services?
Chair Dalton, Representative Greenlee, I don't believe that.
I think A&D is included in the OHV, and so that's how you get the treatment.
A&D is included.
Yeah. Well, that's
you know, this bill, and not just for the two of you, but for whoever else is shepherding this bill. I think it raises a really interesting policy question. The policy question in my mind is, you have somebody who comes in to the system, into the judicial system that is covered by Oregon Health Plan, and when they're coming out, they don't now, you know, they lose their benefits. This would suggest that we should suspend their benefits so that they can come out and I think it says reapply for their benefits or reinstate their benefits. And the question in my mind is, in a situation, in a declining slots environment for the Oregon Health Plan, because we have a less and less number of slots available, the question, the policy question that's a challenging one in my mind is, recognizing the benefits of keeping folks in service after they leave to prevent them from coming back, are we then taking slots and giving them to offenders now, and taking those slots away from, you know, honest, hardworking, low-income Oregonians who aren't offenders? And that's the real challenge, especially in the declining slots. And it's pointed out to us that, or at least to me, that probably a lot of these slots are for folks that are categorically eligible for Medicaid. But if you look at the categories, that would mostly mean moms, I think, and not a lot of the guys who I suspect are the ones that need, you know, the meds and the treatment. So, just a question that I have, and I don't know the answer to it, and before this bill, you know, moves out of this committee, I'm going to need an answer to that. So, if you have some thoughts, Mr. Moore?
Chair Dalto, I will go back and we will prepare a response to that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And Kevin Earls. Who was transformed into...
That's not Kevin Earls. Can't fool us.
Nice try.
Good morning, welcome.
Came back as Bruce
morning,
Bishop.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of Kevin Earls, who appears to
Kevin Earls sinned in this life and returned as Bruce Bishop.
Swallowed up by the building somewhere. We appreciate your consideration of Senate Bill 913. I agree with the chair that it does raise an important issue about how to manage this, the Oregon Health Plan program, and prioritize services for people, particularly those in state institutions. There is a related problem that we would like to bring to the committee's attention, because state institutions that are overcrowded are creating overcrowding in community hospitals. And so we have the same populations that are being served in a continuum of settings from you know, community programs to community hospitals, ultimately to the state hospital. And there are financial issues that are raised for community hospitals as well as safety issues in those facilities. The two specific problems that we're concerned about occur when patients are committed to the care and custody of the state at the state hospital, but there are inadequate beds for them. Those patients are then being held in community hospitals until their placements can be made at the state hospital. Holding them is not appropriate in those acute care facilities because they're not intended to be long-term beds, and it is not uncommon for mentally ill patients to be held in community hospital beds for 30 or longer days before they can be placed at the state hospital. That's creating a problem of access to mental health services because those beds are being occupied by people who are in the custody of the state and other people with mental, you know, mental health needs are not able to be addressed. The second problem occurs because mental health organizations under the Oregon Health Plan are responsible for paying for hospitalization for their members, and there's no standard for payment for those hospitals in the event that they don't have a contract with the hospital. So basically the big picture here is we have a continuum of services that are available, but that continuum is not very well organized and the policies aren't well described about who's responsible for paying for the care. If we could have the opportunity to work with the committee and legislative council, we think there are two specific issues that deserve attention to help make this more of a system than it's currently functioning now. hospitals are bearing the brunt of a lot of the overcrowding at the state hospital. We know you're concerned about fixing that, but while we're fixing that problem, it's really backing up the system across the state. So if we have the opportunity, we would like to work with you on specific amendments to the bill.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no one else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 913, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 913A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 947A. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 947A engross requires the Department of Human Services to make records concerning child abuse reports available to any person if a child suffers a serious physical injury or dies. It allows DHS to exempt specified information from disclosure, and it allows the department, if it does not have a report or record, to disclose that information. This has no revenue or fiscal impact. This comes to us from the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously, 7 aye votes, and the Senate floor, 22 aye votes, no noes, and 8 excused. There's no subsequent referral on this bill, Mr. Chair.
All right. Tom Gallagher and Teresa.
Teresa Bottomley.
Oh. Bottomley? There's a bunch of letters there, but I don't know what they
are. Therese, yes.
Therese, okay. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Therese Bottomley, managing editor of the Oregonian, and I urge you to support greater openness in the case of child abuse deaths. As you consider this bill, you might remember the case of Tucker Sherman. Tucker Sherman, a 5-year-old boy living in the Dalles, died wishing he were a boy named John. When Tucker told a state child protective services worker he wanted to be someone else, she thought it was kind of funny coming from a kid, but never asked why. 10 days later, Tucker was dead. He had 72 bruises on his 35-pound body. An autopsy showed the abuse had gone on for at least 2 months before his death. About the amount of time his teacher had been calling the state for help. Yet Oregonians did not hear the full story of the case for 3 years. After a criminal trial and a $280,000 settlement paid to the family. The settlement brought the total amount paid in 23 child abuse claims in the past decade to nearly $3 million. It was only through the criminal case, a civil suit, and the family that the Oregonian was able to report the complete story. Many times, when children die of abuse in Oregon, state workers refuse to explain what happened, citing confidentiality laws. In the past decade, more than a dozen states have changed their confidentiality laws as reports of murder and abuse children skyrocketed. They open state records to the public in cases of fatalities or near fatalities. They not only allow public disclosure, they require it. This legislature several times has considered joining the move toward more openness. I urge you to do so now. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers. Let me just give you a little background on the workings of this bill. It would take the records that are compiled by DHS and would open those records to any member of the public under the public records law. Those records, the department could exclude any of the names of personal identifiers of any of the parties named in those records if the department determines that that would it's necessary to protect the people involved. A good example given was if some family member is in the file as having turned in, say a grandparent, having turned in the family for abuse, the protection of that grandparent and that family relation would be very important. On the Senate side, we sat down with the department and with the Department of Justice and worked out the amendments to the bill that retain these protections and put the balancing test, the needs of the public against the needs of any of the members that are named in the records. And we put that in the statute. there's been a question to me about the critical incident response team reports that the governor's instigated or instituted. And we think that we've looked at those. We think those are very valuable management tools that are currently being used to review the practices and so forth in these cases. They're not the same thing as the records. We've narrowed these records to children who suffered a fatality or a near fatality. It's modeled on Alicia's law in New York State that Governor Pataki passed in the late 1990s, and 14 other states are looking at the same sort of changing of the statutes on public records for child abuse. We think that it does two things, both of them positive in different ways. The first one is, in many times, the state and other agencies have done everything possible to protect these children. And when you see, read a newspaper story in these areas and they say, they talk to the witnesses, they talk to the parents, they talk to other people, and then they turn to the Children's Services or the Department of Justice, and the answer is, we can't talk about this because we can't disclose anything in the records. It leaves not only a hole, but it doesn't allow the agency to explain exactly what they did and how they expended almost every effort possible in this case. We also think that those kind of reports are going to expose some of the problems in the Children's Services. Underfunding is gets thrown around here all the time. But in many cases, when we've talked to people, those caseloads are too large. One of the cases that we dealt with on the coast was a wonderful caseworker. Makes too little money, has too many cases, and was doing everything she could in overtime and other places on this particular family. Those things need to be brought out into the public. It's the defense of the agency in that sense. The other times where the agency doesn't do what they should do, hopefully will get caught in the critical incident report, and the agency will make those adjustments as they learn from that particular case. But that's part of the public records value. I mean, that's where the stories like the Oregon State Hospital, other stories that you've read politically, have come through public record search by people who spend the time looking through those records and making those connections. So we hope this is a very positive bill for the department and for Oregon, and we hope that it does something positive for children. Thank you very much.
Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't agree more. If it's hard for the newspaper to get information, maybe even tougher for a legislator to get information. I have beaten my head against the wall on cases in our local office, and it's inhuman the way information is tucked away and kept from the public. I understand there are cases that need to be dealt with very, very sensitively, but if we, who basically have charge over the department, cannot get to information that would help us know how to improve the department, I don't know who will. And it's high time that we be able to search out those things that need to be searched out and leave covered what needs to be left covered. I remember very distinctly, and some of the folks who were present are here today, in which I brought four cases that I felt should never have been transitioned. Probably three or four of them never should have been carried to the length that they have, using up caseworker time. If those cases were quickly dealt with, there'd be a lot more time for a lot of caseworkers to work around the state on cases that they have. We wouldn't need to expand. And at the end of it, almost 8 hours of testimony of heartbreaking cases, the response I got was not, how can we help? The response was, we must have some policy problems in our department. My heart was breaking for these families, and their concern was the mechanics. We've got to get past that and get to the heart and the soul of families in the state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that I say two things. And it's not our goal here to leave any of the individuals who are involved in this exposed to public scrutiny. And it's certainly not our desire to sell newspapers with these kinds of stories. There are a number of protections that, as other witnesses come forward, you need to look into. Number one, in the public record statute, there's a protection for law enforcement not to release records when it could hinder a criminal investigation. And this bill is subject to all of those exemptions that are existing inside of the public records law, and that's so stated in the bill. Secondly, our concern is that while there are a number of high-profile cases, and those cases where something tragic happens and perhaps we all want to fix it, those are the minority of cases inside of the department. And I think when we start making statements, making some of those records public, we're going to see the good much more than we're going to see the bad. And so I'm very positive that, and the department has supported this bill from the beginning, I'm very positive that this is a step forward. Thank you.
Yes, Bob.
It's a poor analogy, but even on national security, there are areas where legislators, congressmen, senators, and even the press can be brought in under confidentiality rules.
There is a way legislators can be brought in under confidentiality rules.
We're going to work on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You.
We have Nancy Keeling. Nancy Keeling. Good morning. Welcome.
Morning. Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I'm Nancy Keeling. I'm the administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children at the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 947A. You would normally see Una Swanson in this place today, and Una's not available. The department is supportive of taking steps to increase its accountability to the public. DHS participated in a work group that recommended language changes in Senate Bill 947 that would support this goal without compromising safety and individual privacy rights for individuals. The amended language that is included in Senate Bill 947A will allow for release of information with safeguards that will not compromise child safety, safety of adult victims, or the safety of other parties associated with the case, including the reporter of the abuse. The department supports the amended language. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Appreciate it. You're all set. And then Julie McFarland, Juvenile Rights Project. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 947A. The Juvenile Rights Project represents many children who are the victims of abuse and neglect, and we are concerned that this bill is too broadly drafted to achieve the purpose that we approve of opening the agency to more public accountability, and that it will be harmful to children and families. We believe a more balanced approach is needed that will also consider privacy needs and interests of children and families and the safety concerns that are part of many of these cases. Open and unlimited access to juvenile abuse and neglect records can be very harmful to children. Welcoming outsiders into the intimacy of child abuse cases will result in further intrusion into the lives of children and families that is not always justified. Not only will divulging a child's experiences re-victimize the child, it will cause additional embarrassment and shame for the child. families who have entered the child welfare system are at a vulnerable point in their lives, and embarrassing them will not be helpful. These are very sensitive types of cases that, if made public, would cause extreme embarrassment. For children, this is very difficult. Peers who hear about them on the news are unlikely to be sensitive, and many children do not want to be to admit to being abused, especially children who have been sexually abused, particularly if it's by a same-sex abuser, because of fear that friends and other family members will find out about it. When I am counseling a young person to make such a report, I am always dealing with their lack of willingness to make reports and their fears about public exposure. I and other responsible persons who deal with such young children will have to, in all honesty, tell them after this bill becomes law, if this bill becomes law, that in fact anybody can have access to the records about what they are reporting. There's also information about children's actions in these files, since many children who are the subject of abuse cases are also have also acted out in ways probably as a result of their abuse, which if publicized could essentially brand them for life. It is not uncommon for children to be involved in criminal activity along with their parents, shoplifting, involvement in drugs, delivering drugs. Sexually offended children commonly act out that abuse against other children. There are confidential medical and psychological records that are in these records that would be released, including information about HIV status, sexually transmitted diseases, psychiatric diagnoses, information about hereditary diseases that children may not be aware of. Children are not able to understand implications of these types of information and need to be protected from these being revealed. The protections provided in subsection 2, allowing the exemption from disclosure of names and other identifying information, is really of little protection to these children. Most often in high-profile cases, that information is already in the public. If it is not in the public, then it is just fairly simple challenge to obtain the information about the names of individuals. What we have suggested on the other side, and we suggest again here, is that a better approach to providing more accountability and accessibility to records for the press and the public is to empower juvenile judges, who most often are already involved in these cases, to make these decisions on a case-by-case basis. We have a procedure that we use in court called in-camera inspection, and that means that the judge will take the record that is being requested into his or her chambers, read the entire record, then hear from the parties who are involved in the case and the persons who are requesting disclosure, as well as the other persons who's maybe named in the file, about any concerns they have about disclosure. During this process, what happens in other states where judges do release this information is that they can put restrictions on the press and have release the information only if the press agrees to those restrictions. That, for instance, they're not going to include grandma's name or any identifying facts, not just information about her identity, but facts in the record that would clearly point to her being the person who made the report in this case. This is, in our view, a much better procedure. I think also that we should seriously consider not having this bill extend to cases where there is no determination of abuse and neglect. Children die. Children are seriously injured, and it's not always abuse and neglect that causes that. And it can be very tragic for a family to have further exposure to scrutiny after they've already been scrutinized by the agency to determine whether or not it was a case of abuse. Those would be my comments, and I would ask the committee not to pass this bill out. be happy to take any questions.
So are you suggesting that passage of a bill like this might have a chilling effect on the reporting of some parties to even suggest? The bill is pretty specific about serious physical injury or death, but by the time it filters down to a reporting party or kid level, it's anything that I say would get out in the public. Is that right?
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I think that would definitely be a concern, and I don't know if sex abuse, certainly some types of sex abuse would be defined as serious physical injury. Not all types of sex abuse would, but a child who's been subjected to that, in my experience, and except for very little children who fairly readily report, in my experience, older children, the first thing they want to know, if I tell you this, who else is going to know? And I think it will have a chilling effect.
And then I guess following on that, if you have multiple children in a household and you have a tragedy occurring with one child, if the story isn't over, I guess if this comes out in the public, you still have other survivors within the household.
That's correct, Chair Dalto. And so the information, of course, the agency is if there's a fatality, there's going to be other children, or there may be other children in the household, and they are, of course, going to investigate the circumstances of those children. And, those are children who are going to be going to school every day and probably already having to deal with the fact that there is information in the press about their sibling that their schoolmates may well know about. And then if there's additional information that comes out in the record about them as well, that could be very difficult to handle.
President Greenlee?
Yeah, you have the Engross bill?
Yes.
It's going to be Engross. Does line 9 through 11 on page 2 deal with the question of there not being an allegation of abuse? Does that say if there's no allegation of abuse, report or a record of abuse, then they can refuse to disclose that case? Is that what that means?
Chair Dalto, Representative Greenlee, the situation I'm talking about is where there is a report of abuse that's been investigated and found not to be valid.
I see.
So I think B is actually a good provision, and I would agree that when there is no report, the agency should be able to reveal that. But there are, I forget the numbers, but thousands and thousands of reports. We only investigate about 30% of them. Of those, only 10% or so are found valid. So we have lots of reports. And people who, I think whenever you deal with a seriously injured child or a fatality with a child, you kind of bend over backwards if you're a mandatory reporter to make sure that you're covering everything, and you're going to probably make a report even if you're not very sure that it involves an abusive situation, and then it gets investigated and it's found not to be valid. And I just don't see that there's much point in having those cases revealed as well or disclosed.
Mr. Chairman, I follow up, and this might require an answer from Ms. Bottomley. It's a policy, basically, I understand, of the Oregonian not to report the name of a child who's been sexually abused. This is a case where the name's already there, I think. And then the question is, how do you deal with the fact that you're now reporting, say, sexual abuse on the part of a child whose name is already in the public record? How does it link with, maybe, if I may ask?
You need to come forward to the microphone.
Thank you. The Oregonian, as with most newspapers, does not report by name any sexual abuse victim, unless that victim is, an adult who consents and wants to tell their story. And so I think that in this case, there are many provisions within the wording of this to protect identity in cases where people feel that there is in the best interest the privacy. Also, I'd just remind you that this does incorporate the public records law, which has many exemptions to it, including medical and personal information. So I think there are plenty of protections on the privacy side within the wording of this bill.
I may ask specifically. But in this issue, here's little Ricky Jones, who you know has been injured. That's why you're going after the medical record. I mean, after the subject record. You now get information about the abuse of that child that then becomes a part of your story. I mean, you don't take back, I mean, you don't take the name out of the public record anymore. So Ricky Jones is now the object of your story.
In the case of a fatality, the name would be reported and it would stay reported even as subsequent information comes out. But in the rare cases where we have named an individual and later found that person to be the victim of sexual abuse, you cannot unring the bell, obviously, but we do then stop using the name or any identifying information. I can speak from 23 years experience at the newspaper. It's a very, very rare circumstance. I would also remind you that criminal incident reports in general are open, indictments are public record, juvenile courts under the Diaz ruling, Oregon Supreme Court ruling, in the Diaz case, juvenile courts are open and open to the public. So many of these cases, obviously in the case of a death or a serious, you know, injury, are going to be criminal cases in which those names are going to be out there in the public domain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If I could just make one further comment on the church also. I think also for the children involved, it may not matter that your name is not actually in the paper. And, of course, the Oregonian's policies may not be the same policies that the news, the video media have in terms of using names. But, you know, if the police came to your school and picked you up and, you know, later... you tell your friend that your brother has died, they're going to know who that story is about in the Oregonian and on the news. And that, you know, that's just the reality of life. That, you know, there are a lot of rumors that happen and people are aware of those kind of things. And just leaving out a name is often not enough. It really takes someone looking at what specific facts are in that record that's going to be released that could be harmful.
Okay. Thanks very much. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 947 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 221. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 221A comes to us again from the Senate Judiciary Committee with 6 aye votes. This bill makes certain information obtained by the Department of Human Services in connection with special morbidity and mortality studies confidential, non-discoverable, and inadmissible in any proceeding and exempt from disclosure under public record law. There's no revenue or fiscal impact statement, nor any subsequent referral on the bill. 25 aye votes from the Senate floor, 1 no, and 4 excused.
Epidemiological.
Thank you. And I could have done it if I'd done it right first.
Dr. Sislak.
Who is the no vote?
No vote. Dr. Schrader.
Didn't want dental veterinary epidemiological study.
Good morning, welcome. Dr. Cohn, are you in on this too? I didn't see him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Paul Sislak. I manage the communicable disease section for the Oregon Department of Human Services. I'm not going to read all the testimony, but I do want to describe the case that made us bring the legislation forward. There was a case of Dr. Dave Gilbert in Portland reported to us a case of hepatitis C a couple of years ago that occurred in a patient of his who had none of the known risk factors for hepatitis C. Often it's thought that it's usually from drug use. This patient had no history of injection drug use. So where did it come from? Well, the patient had received a transplanted, I think, tendon some weeks before, and so the question arose, could the hepatitis C have come from the transplanted tendon? And that's why Dr. Gilbert gave me the phone call. Well, we started to look into it, and the way we do that is we call up the surgeon and say, where'd you get the tendon that you transplanted into the patient? And the surgeon says, that's in the patient's medical record. You'll have to get that. And we call the medical records, and we say, can we see the patient's medical record? And usually they have a couple questions about confidentiality, and we respond to them that under the special study statute, Oregon Revised Statute 432.060, which was passed more than 20 years ago, the information that they give to us can be used only for the purposes of study that we're doing. So we're sort of reassuring them on the legal basis. Then we get the information. We find here's where the tendon came from. We call the tissue bank and say, who was the donor of this tendon? You have records of it. And they said, well, it was somebody who was in his 40s who died of unrelated causes. And, we have some serum. We're going to test the serum from this donor for you. We said, don't transplant any of the remaining tissues into people. A body gets carved up into this one got carved up into 90 tissues. About 40 of them had been transplanted into people, but about half of them had not been. And we launched our investigation. We said, can you tell us all the physicians that you sent these tissues to? And they sent them all around the country. And we elicited those physicians' cooperation and said, can you call the patients, bring them in, get a sample for hepatitis? And we went from there. So I'm trying to illustrate that all along the way, we're trying to both move quickly and to get the voluntary cooperation of a variety of people from whom we need cooperation. They've all got a little bit of worries about legality on their mind, and we're trying to reassure them with this statute. Well, this case did come to litigation, and all of our records were subpoenaed. We asked the judge to quash the subpoena, saying it's protected under the special study statute, and after a long discussion, the judge said you have to turn everything over. So we had to turn over, for example, names of other physicians in other states who had gotten these organs unknowingly, not knowing that they were contaminated, and transplanted them into people, and it is for this reason that we are bringing the legislation forward. I do not believe that without the ability to tell them that the information they give us won't be used against them, we're going to be able to get their cooperation on a rapid basis. The judge in the case suggested that we should just subpoena them, and my response to you all is that I don't think we have the authority to subpoena anything. My attorney tells me that. And secondly, I want to move more rapidly than subpoenaing records and working through a legal process would allow us to do. I don't want their reluctant compliance. I want their willing cooperation so that we can move quickly. We did try to make sure that the stuff that is already subpoenaable from the private sources remains that way. We're not trying to protect anything that isn't involved with this special study. We're just trying to protect the information that people voluntarily provide us in connection with trying to do a study like this.
Paul, can I ask you a question just to make clear that the issue here, this wasn't a research study for you to write a paper on. The purpose in this case was to protect, say, the other 40 people who might have gotten tissues from getting hepatitis C, and also perhaps notifying those that did have an infected tissue that they might be exposed to hepatitis C. I mean, it's essentially to protect the health of some unknown people and some known people.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, that's correct. Our first order of business was to say, please don't transplant any more of these tissues. And they did that. So about half the tissues never went into people because we got on it right away. In addition, we did try to investigate who got it and which tissues were likely to transmit it and which tissues were not. We notified the FDA that there was a problem here. The testing that was done was the currently recommended testing on this person who died. He was tested for hepatitis C and tested negative. you know, is there other testing that's needed? Because we're a public agency, you know, we see it as our responsibility to tell other people what we've learned from this unfortunate incident. And so, you know, we actually are planning to publish our findings on this. But the primary purpose of the study was to stop it from going into anybody else, identify people who had been infected so that they could make treatment decisions, et cetera. Did you want to, Sam, add anything now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services. I want to say just a few words. First, I want to underscore the importance of this bill for the work that we do and try to do every day to protect the health of Oregonians. I think, as Dr. Cieslak has said, without the kind of protections afforded in this bill, it's really going to hinder our ability to do our job and protect people the way that we're supposed to be doing. I wanted to say just one or two words also about other concerns that have been raised about this bill. You'll notice this is the A-engrossed version. There have been some amendments. We're very comfortable with those amendments, narrowing the scope of the information that's protected under this bill a little bit. We have had extensive discussions with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association about this bill and have not been able to reach consensus about language that we're both comfortable with. We have also heard from the Oregon Newspapers Publishers Association. I think Mr. Gallagher has left the room already, but and they have been supportive of this bill. And I think it's easy to understand why, because the information that we collect is also something that they would be interested in covering in newspapers as well. So with that, I will stop. I'll be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Okay. I don't see any questions. Before I let you go, Dr. Cieslak, the measure that was lost on the House floor on Friday, I could not have been more furious on Friday about losing that measure. And so we're going to bring that up for reconsideration. Today, I think we're going to bring that back to committee. I don't understand how a measure that gets 6 votes in this committee gets 15 on the House floor. It did. And so I don't have a whole lot of history with that bill. I know that thermiosol is something that has controversy surrounding it, but I think that the department has a lot of work to do if they want to pass that bill. And my expectation is going to be that that bill will come back to committee and that the department will have to go and educate members of the House about this bill. And I won't move that bill out of this committee again unless we have an understanding that members of the House have a sufficient enough understanding of the protections afforded in the law so that that doesn't, any concerns that they are having about thermiosol doesn't become a problem. So I've said my piece. Now
at your service.
Could I ask them a question about that bill?
Yes, Representative Greenlake.
It seems to me the current law really doesn't apply to flu vaccine. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, strictly speaking, that is correct. It has been interpreted by our immunization program perhaps too strictly, saying we think this was meant to protect every vaccine and not just the vaccines that are required for school entry. Perhaps that was too strict an interpretation.
But it certainly only says vaccines required. I mean, it's very the language is very explicit. I don't know how you could have interpreted it to mean anything but that language. That was part of the issue that I missed the first time through, which I apologize for screwing up. I mean, I felt really bad about the fiasco. But it seems to me you have absolute authority under that bill to do whatever you need to do for flu vaccine.
We'll have to go back and take another look at that.
Was it your Attorney General that...
No, I think it was a programmatic interpretation within the department.
Could you quickly find out whether you think you really do need the authority in that bill or not? I mean, that would be very helpful for us, because my reading is you literally don't need that bill to do what you said you wanted the bill for.
Will do.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you both. Scott Gallant. You guys, are we okay with this bill? This one. Mitch, are we okay with this bill?
Yes. Yeah, this is an important bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with Oregon Medical Association. We support this bill. It's a good bill. We would encourage you to move the bill out of committee for passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 221A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 221A. Sandy, will you check to see if the good Dr. Representative Anderson is outside?
Thanks.
Does it represent Dr. Anderson?
Yes. I'd be happy to carry this if you'd like.
I'm going to ask you to.
Do a little penance for...
Mr. Chair, I apologize for coming in so late.
Were you in the budget committee?
Yes. You're a member of this committee.
Did you pass a budget today for us?
No, he didn't. It started at 8:30, I know I'm a member of both of them.
Oh, you're a member of that one?
Yes.
I was not aware of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's why I've been doing that. It's been very difficult.
Never mind.
Okay. Mr. Chair, would you like a motion on this?
Representative Greenlee.
I move Senate Bill 221 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Greenlee moves Senate Bill 221A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Greenwood.
Aye.
Excused.
Butler.
Excused. Chair votes aye. Senate Bill 221A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Greenlee is requested to carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, I was trying to remember whether have we passed out that Senate bill on the vaccination. You remember, we have all the we have amendments that everybody took care of. Representative Butler's mind. I don't remember whether we acted on it or we didn't act on it.
Are you talking about Senate Bill 225?
That sounds right.
I think we did.
We did pass it.
No, we did. I will have to check. I don't have my record.
We did.
We did pass it, didn't we? And put it on the consent calendar, as I remember.
No, I was going to carry it, but you can put it on consent if you want.
No, you're carrying it, Bill.
You're carrying it? It's still coming up, then.
Right.
That's what I hear.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure we got that.
Just don't be absent that day and give it to him.
First of all, we need to... Yes.
Okay.
Maybe Billy's the one to carry it.
No.
You're still on the record with all of this.
Yes, that's fine. We have closed the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 221A. And seeing no other business coming for us, we are adjourned.